Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Matthew Ho, a former Marine and State Department official who resigned in protest over U.S.-Afghanistan policy, explains why he opposes President Obama's request for congressional war authorization to combat ISIS. Samuel Fay, a Yale University researcher, who summarizes a new study he co-authored that found an accelerating rate of species mass die-offs across the globe. And James Henry, senior fellow at Columbia University's Center for Sustainable International Investment, who summarizes leaked documents that reveal HSBC Bank's dirty dealings with tax dodgers, drug traffickers, and arms dealers. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Even after an increase in the number of Ebola cases in West Africa, President Obama announced a dramatic cut in U.S. troops deployed to Liberia to battle the deadly disease, which has killed over 9,000 people in the last year. At the same time, the World Health Organization, or WHO, faces growing criticism for its slow response to the Ebola outbreak last spring. In recent weeks, Sierra Leone and Guinea have reported a spike in Ebola cases. A WHO statement pointed out the considerable challenges in West Africa to end the Ebola outbreak. Despite the falloff of Ebola cases in Liberia, President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf warned that there is a continuing danger that the disease could come back, as she encouraged international donors to invest in rebuilding West Africa's healthcare infrastructure. The International Monetary Fund recently granted $100 million in debt relief to Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea. Over the past year, the World Bank estimates that Ebola-impacted nations lost over $1.6 billion in economic activity. Taking a page out of the political playbook of Wisconsin GOP Governor Scott Walker, newly elected Illinois Republican Governor Bruce Rauner, a former private equity manager, issued an executive order ending the legal requirement for Illinois state workers who are not members of unions to pay agency or fair share fees to cover the costs to the union for bargaining on their behalf. According to the news magazine In These Times, this is likely only the beginning of a long battle between Rauner, the first Republican governor in Illinois in a decade, and state unions supported by the Democratic majority in the state legislature. In his State of the State address, Rauner encouraged municipal governments to pass local right-to-work laws. Right-to-work is a deliberately misleading term describing regulations that usually abolish the practice of requiring automatic union membership and dues payment in unionized workplaces, and that often leads to a decline in union ranks. Roberta Lynch, head of AFSCME Council 31, declared, "Bruce Rauner's scheme to strip the rights of 6,500 state workers and weaken their unions by executive order is a blatant abuse of power." The Republican governor's legal team, led by former prosecutor Dan Webb, has already asked the Illinois Supreme Court for a declaratory judgment on the executive order. In the near future, the U.S. Supreme Court is expected to take up a case that could result in a ruling that would bar automatic dues payment from public employees under any circumstances. According to the Center for Public Integrity, nationally, juvenile courts adjudicated over 1.2 million cases of young people charged with delinquency in 2011. At the same time, nearly 4 million children across the U.S. were reported to have suffered abuse or neglect. A report by the Robert F. Kennedy Children's Action Corps noted, "Dual-status youth endure higher detention rates, increased recidivism, and inferior school performance than children not involved in either the child welfare or juvenile justice systems." Now, five states, including New Hampshire and New Mexico, have centralized the administration of child welfare and juvenile justice to improve coordination of services. Nihad Desai, who runs a dual-status youth program in the San Francisco Bay Area, observed, "Probation officers and social workers have never, ever worked together before, because it was a combative relationship, or in many cases there was no communication. Now there are a growing number of collaborative programs that provide counseling to youth to succeed in school, address behavioral problems, and prepare for enrollment in college." This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
Atrocities committed by ISIS terrorists continue to be the focus of world attention. After a succession of beheadings of Western hostages and the burning alive of a captured Jordanian fighter pilot, ISIS released a new video documenting the beheading of 21 Egyptian Christians on the shore of the Mediterranean Sea in Libya. The next day, Egyptian fighter jets bombed ISIS targets in Libya that included militant training sites and weapons storage areas. ISIS now reportedly has a presence in 9 nations beyond their initial area of operations in Syria and northern Iraq. With public fear rising about religiously inspired violence in the Middle East and a series of recent attacks in Western Europe, President Obama asked Congress on February 11th to formally authorize the use of military force in the fight against ISIS, although U.S. and coalition airstrikes have been carried out since August. The president stated that the authorization for the use of military force, or AUMF, does not call for the deployment of ground troops in Iraq or Syria. The joint resolution would limit his authority to wage a military campaign against ISIS to 3 years, and does not authorize what's called enduring offensive ground combat operations. Your reporter spoke with Matthew Ho, senior fellow at the Center for International Policy, a former Marine captain who in 2009 resigned his State Department post as the senior U.S. civilian in Zabul province in protest of American policy in Afghanistan. Here he explains why he opposes President Obama's request for congressional war authorization to combat ISIS.
This authorization is post facto. He's already been doing it for 6 months or so. It has incredibly vague language to it and very subjective language to it. To give you an example, with the notion about enduring ground combat troops. And yes, the president sent a letter to Congress saying there won't be ground combat troops, there'll just be rescue operations and commando raids. But that's just a letter. That's not what the resolution, the authorization that will come from Congress will say. It will just say no enduring ground combat. Well, I give you an example. When I was in Iraq in 2005, in my first year there, the definition of enduring was at that point what our presence in Germany or Japan was, that troops will be stationed someplace and stationed permanently. Their families would live with them. So if that's still the definition used by the U.S. government for enduring, then anything beneath somebody being stationed permanently in Iraq with their family is not classified as an enduring ground combat operation. So it's an incredibly subjective and vague terminology that's being used. There is a 3-year limit on this authorization, but what that effectively does is just places any decision making into the hands of President Obama's successor, which is very similar to what President George W. Bush did with Iraq and Afghanistan by pushing the wars off to his successor, which turned out to be President Obama. However, I think, Scott, the most important thing is that regardless of whether or not Congress authorizes this, regardless of whether or not President Obama has the legal authority to do this, he is doing it, and it's not being effective, and it will not be effective. And there's no evidence that these wars will reduce the Islamic State, will contain the Islamic State, will make the lives of the people in Iraq or Syria or the Middle East better, because all the evidence points to the opposite.
And Matthew, as you and our listeners are aware, there's a lot of emotion tied up with what the United States should do, the decision-making here in the near term about ISIS. Certainly, this group is practicing terrorism, indiscriminate slaughter of people based on their religious beliefs. You also have a lot of horrendous treatment of women, selling them into sexual slavery and the like. If not military force, Matthew, what are some of the alternatives that need to be debated here in Congress as they consider the president's request for authorization for a new war here?
So what should we be doing? We should be taking a more appropriate, more neutral role in these conflicts. We should not be involved militarily. We should not be selling weapons to repressive governments. Continuation of the policies, a continuation of trying to pick and choose winners and losers in these Middle Eastern civil wars, is just going to continue the same. It's just going to make defense companies rich. It's going to embolden and strengthen extremist groups like Al-Qaeda or the Taliban or the Islamic State, and will serve no purpose in providing for the security of the United States.
I'm sure during this congressional debate, there's going to be a lot of discussion of the existential threat that ISIS presents to the United States and the West in general. ISIS now has a presence in 11 nations. They've attracted some 20,000 recruits internationally. There's reports that as many as 3,400 Western recruits have arrived to fight in Syria and Iraq. How do you respond to the idea that somehow military action is necessary here, Matthew, because of the existential threat that ISIS presents?
Well, I don't think the Islamic State ISIS presents an existential threat to us. They might be able to blow up some cafes or blow up an airplane, but we haven't seen the Islamic State actually go forth in any type of manner to conduct international terrorism like that. What we've seen them be involved in are these local and regional conflicts, a lot of which breaks down along the lines that the United States has fostered, this Saudi-Iranian proxy war, the Sunni versus Shia, this Arab versus Persian proxy war that we've been sponsoring for decades now. But, I mean, basically, Scott, it comes down to this. Look, if military force worked, the Islamic State wouldn't have spread from Iraq and Syria to nine other countries in the last 6 months. If military force worked, the Islamic State wouldn't be recruiting thousands of followers every year. So what we're seeing, and again, this goes back decades, that our policy of intervention, which is really just inept meddling, the most gracious way to describe it, has not worked, and it has created greater instability, these awful civil wars that are spiraling out of control, and allow for these parasites, again, the Islamic State, the Taliban, Al-Qaeda, to take advantage of the cycle of violence and hatred that these wars beget.
That was Matthew Ho, senior fellow at the Center for International Policy. Find more analysis and commentary on the U.S. war against ISIS by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. A new report published in the prestigious peer-reviewed journal Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, USA, documents a likely future increase in mass mortality events, that is, the death in a short period of large numbers of a species, sometimes in the millions, and on occasion, wiping out an entire local population. The study presents an analysis of 727 published mass mortality events from across the globe, affecting more than 2,400 animal populations. Researchers found the magnitude of these events has been intensifying for birds, fish, and marine invertebrates, unchanged for mammals, and decreasing for reptiles and amphibians. The overall number of mortality events has increased by one per year over the past 70 years and are associated with a rise in starvation, disease, biotoxicity, and other events triggered by multiple factors. It's unclear what role, if any, climate change has played in this increase. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Samuel Fay, a postdoctoral fellow in the Department of Ecology and Evolutionary Biology at Yale University, and a co-author of the report, along with researchers from the University of San Diego and UC Berkeley. Here, Fay describes what prompted his team to research the issue of mass mortality and the impact of these events on the local ecology.
We talked about kind of how kind of surprising they are and how kind of morbidly fascinating some of these events can be. But then, you know, as the discussion moved on, we started to talk a little bit about how often these events are seemingly blips on our radar and that they attract a large amount of coverage, but then in general aren't put into any greater context in the media. And so we looked to see if there was any synthesis across different animal mass mortality events that began to look at some of the changes in occurrence, causes, and magnitudes of these events through time. And we were really surprised when we learned that there hadn't been any effort like this. So we thought this would be a good opportunity to try to shed some light on a process that attracts a lot of attention but is rarely put into any greater context.
Can you give me one example? I think there was one where it was a huge die-off of starfish?
Yeah, so this didn't make it into our database because we stopped reporting on events in 2012, I believe. But yeah, there's an ongoing sea star mortality event that has been occurring on the west coast of North America where millions of starfish have died. And it does beg the question of, you know, what are the ecological consequences of this type of event? I mean, certainly that amount of dead biomass could certainly be used as a resource by any organism that's able to take advantage of that. And it also has the potential to just disrupt entire food webs in terms of how those organisms interact with their predators and their prey.
In the article I read about it, it said that there was an increase in mass mortality events among birds, fish, and invertebrates, a decrease in mass mortality events among reptiles and amphibians, and among mammals it stayed the same. Mm. I don't think your study reached any conclusions, but do you have any thoughts on that?
For the magnitudes or the number of individuals that died during any of these reported events, we saw that there was increases for birds, fishes, and marine invertebrates, that there hadn't been any change in the magnitude through time for mammals, and that there had been decreases through time for reptiles and amphibians. And at first glance, you might think that, you know, as magnitudes are increasing, that might be kind of an alarm in the sense that, you know, are these bigger die-offs caused by more severe perturbations to natural systems? And so, you know, that certainly may be true. But the alternative take on this is that perhaps the smaller sizes of reptile and amphibian die-offs that have occurred through time might be just due to the fact that there are smaller extant population sizes for these taxa. There are many more threatened species of amphibians and reptiles than there are for these other groups, which suggests the possibility that perhaps, you know, having small population sizes in nature precludes the occurrence of any really large event.
So some of the reasons that were given for different events, one was starvation, one was disease, one was biotoxicity, and then there was a combination of multiple stressors that acted together. How much do you see connections with climate change resulting in any of these die-offs? Is that something you're looking at? Is that something you know is a factor?
So it's really difficult to take any of the causes that we show in our study and connect them directly to something like climate change. However, it is interesting to look at the trends and the causes underlying these events. For instance, one of the causes in our database is thermal stress. And over the course of this 70-year period of time, we did see a decrease in the number of events caused by cold thermal stress. And so it's interesting that this is in keeping with patterns that we've seen in recent climate change related to decreases in the severity of winter. So, you know, at this point, it just shows that there is perhaps an association, but by no means does it implicate climate change directly in patterns of these events.
Your paper mentions that it's not totally clear if there's really been an increase of one mass mortality event every year for the past 70 years, or if they're just being reported more than before.
This is, as one researcher put it, is the problem of deciding whether something is an epidemic versus an epidemic of awareness. And so we have recorded that there has been an increase in the number of mass mortality events reported through time, but whether this is a real or perceived increase is, you know, somewhat equivocal at this point. What we did in this study is we do know that there has been an increase in the total scientific output over the same period of time in the study, this past 70 years. And so we tried to use the increases in scientific productivity to try to correct for the increases of these events that have been reported through time. And what that analysis showed is that, you know, this increase in scientific productivity, now that there's more scientists on the planet, there's more peer-reviewed scientific journals out there, that correcting that accounts for some but not all of the increase in reported mass mortality events through time.
That was Samuel Fay, a postdoctoral fellow in the Department of Ecology and Evolutionary Biology at Yale University and a co-author of a recently published paper about mass mortality events around the world. Find links to the study and related articles by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. A team of journalists from 45 nations who investigated documents leaked by a former systems engineer working for banking giant HSBC's Geneva, Switzerland branch found HSBC-managed secret bank accounts for criminals, drug traffickers, tax dodgers, politicians, and celebrities. The documents covering the period from 2005 to 2007 revealed, according to the Guardian newspaper, that HSBC aggressively marketed schemes likely to enable wealthy clients to avoid European taxes and provided accounts to international criminals, corrupt businessmen, and other high-risk individuals. One of the news organizations leading the investigation, the International Consortium for Investigative Journalists, declared that how the offshore banking industry shelters money and hides secrets has enormous implications for societies across the globe. Academics conservatively estimate that $7.6 trillion is held in overseas tax havens, costing government treasuries at least $200 billion a year. HSBC, one of the world's largest banks headquartered in London, operates in 74 nations. The bank is now the target of government investigations in France, the U.S., Belgium, and Argentina. In 2012, state and U.S. federal officials opted not to indict HSBC in a money laundering case over concerns that criminal charges could endanger the giant financial institution. Instead, the bank agreed to pay a $1.92 billion fine. Your reporter spoke with James Henry, a senior fellow at Columbia University's Center for Sustainable International Investment and senior advisor with the Tax Justice Network. Here he discusses the investigation into HSBC's illegal activities and the lack of accountability for politically connected financial institutions and wealthy bankers.
HSBC is the largest bank in the world by total assets, and it's not a Swiss bank. It's a UK-headquartered bank, which has a Geneva branch. And the Geneva branch is the one that where the whistleblower, Falciani, fled the country with a big CD, a few CDs of more than 130,000 private client names. Most of the people involved here were, relatively small, $500,000 or $1 million accounts, but some of them were quite a bit larger. We have, the King of Morocco, King of Jordan, some of the wealthiest people in Latin America, about 2,000 Americans, and, several thousand from Argentina, quite a few from the UK and Germany. And HSBC did plead guilty to another whole set of criminal activities involving sanctions busting, trading with Iran, and laundering money for the Mexican cartel, up to $14 billion of that. That plea was taken by the current candidate for Attorney General, Loretta Lynch, who's being asked, that was negotiated in 2012. The bank didn't lose its license. Nobody went to jail. It paid a $1.9 billion fine, but that's like a rounding error as a fraction of its profit. And none of these tax evasion cases that HSBC, the U.S. government already had the data on taxpayers who were using HSBC, none of those cases were prosecuted by Lynch when she was in charge of this case. So those are questions for her that are being asked actively this week in Congress by Senator Warren and some other congresspeople are very concerned about the sort of the light touch with respect to these banks. I mean, the overall pattern that we see is that not just in tax dodging, but a whole plethora of other criminal activities by major financial institutions. The top 22, I've added up the numbers, have committed a total of 655 financial infractions since 2000. So the overall pattern is, sure, they have to pay fines, but then they just go on with business as usual, and nobody goes to jail. None of the senior executives are even displaced. If anything, the banks have figured out that it takes so long to bring them to justice that by the time the penalties are exacted, financial penalties, they've long since realized the benefits of the profits.
James Henry, we can surmise that there are relationships in place between the officers of these large banks in this country and around the world with political officials that really dictates government policy when these banks are caught breaking the law. Maybe you could summarize for us some of what you know about these relationships and how they affect the lack of prosecution here and accountability.
Well, I think there's no secret that the role of money in politics has expanded greatly since the 1990s. And we've had the Citizens United case and, a long line of decisions that have enabled companies to be much more influential politically and also to have virtually unlimited kind of lobbying efforts in Washington. So if you add up the total amount of lobbying expenditures and political contributions by HSBC over the last 10 years, it's in the neighborhood of $39 million. You know, similar numbers for two other major Swiss banks, UBS and Credit Suisse, that were lightly penalized during this period for tax dodging and other crimes. So more than $100 million put into U.S. political influence by, you know, basically foreign banks. And, of course, the American banks have not been asleep. They've been spending even more. So both political parties have learned to treat Wall Street and the, you know, City of London and Geneva and Zurich as, you know, big contributors and major influencers in Washington.
Well, James, in closing, I wanted to have you tackle this question, if you could. That is, what you feel are the prescriptions here to address this huge problem, meaning reform and restructuring? What needs to be done?
Well, at one level, it's a political problem. I mean, my hunch is that banks have become too powerful and, politically, and the recipe for that is not only economic but political. I mean, there's a good argument that I think more Americans are beginning to sympathize with for simply breaking them up. I mean, they're just too big. That's the kind of structuring that's, you know, pretty radical to talk about, but it's been done successfully in some countries and, you know, making for a more competitive banking system, one with more real constraints on speculation by banks, on tax dodging, the facilitation of tax dodging by big banks, especially big banks that are taking money from taxpayers to stay in business. And that's just outrageous. We've seen that the enforcement approach doesn't really work. It takes years. Banks can pass along the fines. They don't really change their behavior necessarily. And the CEOs stay in power. We need tougher crackdown on holding the bankers responsible for their behavior. And we need more proactive regulation that keeps them out of this dubious business of helping the wealthy evade taxes.
That was James Henry, a senior fellow at Columbia University's Center for Sustainable International Investment and a senior advisor with the Tax Justice Network. Find links to the HSBC investigation and related articles on our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.